president of the Bundesbank, was among those who learned about Draghi's message through the news. None of Europe's capitals had received advance warning, nor had Klaus Regling, the head of the EFSF, whose agency would play a key role in Draghi's plan. Draghi had had nothing precise in mind, said an official at the ECB's headquarters in Frankfurt. It was a rash remark. As Reuters put it, Draghi's words were a gamble. The speech was just the beginning. If Draghi's speech was a rallying call, what mattered was who followed. Over the weekend, Eurogroup chief Jean-Claude Juncker threw himself behind Draghi. "The world is talking about whether the Eurozone will still exist in a few months," he declaimed. Europe had arrived at a decisive point. Juncker warned the German government about allowing itself the luxury of getting caught up in domestic politics in Euro questions. Meanwhile, Merkel, Monti and Hollande issued joint statements insisting on their determination to hold the Euro together. To complete the Eurozone quadrilateral, Monti announced that he would shuttle to Madrid to meet with Rajoy. Washington was quick to jump on Draghi's bandwagon. On the morning of Monday, July 30th, Treasury Secretary Geithner flew to Europe to visit Schäuble at his vacation residence on Sylt. The media were divided over what transpired. Some reported agreement, others a dogged refusal by the German to compromise. Geithner was concerned that Germany was still toying with dumping Greece out of the Eurozone. As he wrote in his memoirs, "The argument was that letting Greece burn would make it easier to build a stronger Europe with a more credible firewall. I found the argument terrifying. Letting Greece go could create a spectacular crisis of confidence. The flight from Europe might be impossible to reverse." It wasn't clear to Geithner either why a German electorate would feel much better about rescuing Spain or Portugal or anyone else. After seeing Schäuble, Geithner dropped in on Draghi in Frankfurt. As Geithner later recalled, the upshot was far from reassuring. Draghi told Geithner that his remarks in London had been prompted on the spot by the deep scepticism he had sensed in his audience of hedge fund managers. He realized that he would need to shake the markets. As Geithner put it, he was alarmed by that and decided to add to his remarks, and off the cuff, basically, made a bunch of statements like, "We'll do whatever it takes." Ridiculous. Totally impromptu. Draghi, at that point, he had no plan. He had made this sort of naked statement. On his return to Washington, Geithner was pessimistic. "I told the president that I was deeply worried, and he was too. A European implosion could have knocked us back into recession, or even another financial crisis. As countless pundits noted, we didn't want that to happen in an election year, but we wouldn't have wanted that to happen in any year." In fact, German opposition to Draghi's initiative was fierce. Some insiders are convinced that it was not until the German government's joint meeting with its Chinese counterparts on August 30th that Merkel and Schäuble were finally committed to backing the ECB's initiative and holding Greece in the currency zone. Chinese Prime Minister Wen Jiabao certainly made clear that he held the major European countries, Germany and France, responsible for the destiny of the Eurozone, and that continued Chinese purchases of European bonds depended on their taking effective action. Perhaps the position of the Obama administration was too familiar by this point, and the battle lines too clearly drawn to carry much additional weight. As usual, the inflation hawks at the Bundesbank were aghast at the idea of ECB bond buying. But for Merkel, it was the better of two bad options. For Spain to have been supported out of the funds of the ESM would have raised far more serious political and legal issues. On September 6th, the Bundesbank made its displeasure known by casting the lone vote against Draghi's plan. Indeed, Weidmann was so indignant that he demanded an interview with Draghi to impress upon him that the Bundesbank should not be regarded as just another vote on the ECB's council. It must have a veto. But with backing from both Merkel and Schäuble, the die was cast. The ECB formalized its new role as a conditional lender of last resort under the title of Outright Monetary Transactions, OMT. But this was a strictly conditional promise. The ECB would go into action only if the country in question had agreed on an austerity and aid program approved by the ESM. It was hedged with far more conditions than the unconditional bond buying in which the ECB had engaged under Trichet. Even after Draghi's "whatever it takes" speech, the ECB's monetary policy was profoundly constrained. The same was not true to the same degree for its counterpart in the United States. In 2012, the pace of the U.S. recovery was flagging. The conservative stampede that had opposed any further expansion of monetary activism in 2011 had run its course. On September 13, 2012, the FOMC voted for QE3. It would be the biggest Fed expansion yet. Initially, the Fed committed to purchasing $40 billion per month in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac agency bonds. What was different was that it undertook to do so until the Fed saw substantial improvement in the outlook for the labor market. Additionally, the FOMC announced that it would likely maintain the federal funds rate near zero as long as unemployment remained above 6.5% and the Fed's inflation forecast did not exceed 2.5%. On December 12, 2012, the FOMC announced an increase in the amount of purchases from $40 billion to $85 billion per month. Because of its open-ended nature, QE3 would earn the popular nickname QE Infinity. In his memoirs, Bernanke commented, "Like Mario Draghi, we were declaring we would do whatever it takes." But this was far too kind to the Europeans. Draghi's OMT, as it emerged by September 2012, was a conditional confidence-building measure. It worked by calming markets and stopping the panic. But beyond that, it provided no stimulus to the Eurozone economy. In truth, the ECB's possibilities were limited. QE for Europe, with Germany's conservatives on the warpath, was unthinkable. As the Eurozone economy stagnated and its banks deleveraged, the LTRO facilities were progressively paid back. Unlike the Fed, whose balance sheet Bernanke was actively expanding, the ECB's balance sheet contracted back to where it had been in the crisis-ridden fall of 2011. Europe was sliding ever deeper into its second recession. If one asks how the acute phase of the Eurozone crisis was finally halted, Draghi's July 26th speech offers two answers. One was that given by Draghi himself. The Eurozone crisis was halted because of the enormous investment of political capital made by Europe's governments. It was halted by the construction of a new apparatus of government, the Greek restructuring, the fiscal compact, banking union, ESM, the ECB's OMT facility. Those who bet against the Eurozone's future misjudged the scale of the investment being made by Europe's governments. That was the message that Draghi wanted to ram home. As Draghi said, it was a political message about the seriousness of European state-building. The delays might come at a huge cost to its citizens, but in its usual crab-like fashion, Europe was moving once more toward ever closer union. But the answer extracted from the speech by most of those who heard Draghi that day in the City of London was rather different. They remained sceptical of the EU and uninterested in the details of its politics. What they took from Draghi's speech was not its specific content or the sea change in Eurozone politics that made it possible. They heard one single and simple message. Here was a powerful central banker, and he was saying that he would do whatever it takes. Finally, a European policymaker had realized what was needed. He was speaking the language of the financial Powell doctrine in the City of London to an audience of investors in English. What Draghi was signaling was that Europe finally got it. Implicit in this rendition of what happened in the summer of 2012 is another narrative at odds with Draghi's intended meaning. Whatever it takes was, in fact, a form of surrender. The Eurozone was finally giving in to what Anglophone economic commentators had been calling for all along. If only the ECB had moved to the Fed model earlier, as Obama had spelled out at Cannes, the worst of the Eurozone crisis might have been avoided. What Draghi now promised was what Geithner, Bernanke, and Obama had been preaching to the Europeans since 2010— Do it our way. Nor was it a coincidence that it was Draghi, an American-trained economist, a Goldman Sachs associate, a paid-up member of the global financial community, a friend of Ben, an internationalized urbane Italian, not a provincial German, who delivered this conclusion to the agonizing story of the Eurozone crisis. The Draghi formula, America's formula, was self-fulfilling. He spoke the magic words. The markets stabilized. The Eurozone was saved by its belated Americanization. Looking back over the course of events since 2007, if one stopped the historical clock in the autumn of 2012, the story of the North Atlantic financial crisis could thus be twisted back into a familiar shape. Faced with a crisis of historic proportions, after its own fashion, the Obama administration had delivered a 21st-century demonstration of hegemonic leadership. It lacked the urgency and razzmatazz of the Marshall Plan era, but the upshot was decisive. Not only had America led the way through its own domestic stimulus and monetary policy programs, through discreet diplomacy and the Fed's massive liquidity programs, it had helped Europe across its worst crisis since the end of World War II. Americanization was the answer. Nor were the exponents of U.S. economic policy shy about trumpeting their achievements. The Courage to Act would be the title of Bernanke's memoir. The melodrama caused his more bashful European colleagues to wince. It was not the kind of language one associates with the recollections of an academic economist turned central banker. Other, more academic titles in the wake of the 2012 stabilization echoed the general mood of optimism. In the end, it had turned out to be a status quo crisis, and the system worked. The global economy had survived, and America had reasserted a new version of liberal hegemony. Europe resumed the forward march to a United States of Europe it had begun under American guidance in 1947. Among academic commentators, a cottage industry grew up on both sides of the Atlantic, benchmarking Europe's new efforts at integration against American history. Was Europe still at the Philadelphia stage, or was a Hamilton moment on the horizon? It was, one should add, a reasonable assessment, certainly if one stopped the clock in November 2012, and if one skated over America's unfortunate role in 2010, in endorsing the first round of Extend and Pretend. This narrative was also, in the American context, a thoroughly political one. As Geithner acknowledged, 2012 was an election year, and if the financial crisis and its European aftermath had finally been contained, the Democrats deserved whatever credit was due. Since 2008, the congressional Republicans had been obstructive, if not downright dangerous. Campaigning for a second term as president in 2012, Obama cashed in. Gone was the modesty that characterized his speeches in 2008 and 2009 in the wake of the embarrassment of the Bush presidency. Now Obama trumpeted American exceptionalism without reserve. I see it everywhere I go, from London and Prague, to Tokyo and Seoul, to Rio and Jakarta, he declared to a group of Air Force cadets in the summer of 2012. There is a new confidence in our leadership. America remains the one indispensable nation in world affairs. I see an American century because no other nation seeks the role that we play in global affairs, and no other nation can play the role that we play in global affairs. As far as international economic policy was concerned, Obama's victory in November 2012, Bernanke's QE3, and Draghi's speech combined to put the seal on the narrative. Centrist, liberal crisis management had prevailed. In America's new century, diversity, world openness, and technocratic pragmatism would go hand in hand. But this reconciled narrative of crisis resolution obscures deep tensions on both sides of the Atlantic. In Europe, the Eurozone had survived. Draghi was right. An important phase of state building had emerged from the crisis. But it was at an appalling economic and political cost. The governments of Italy and Greece had been overturned. Ireland and Portugal had been put on troika tutelage, and Spain had escaped by the skin of its teeth. And though the acute sovereign bond crisis was over, after 2 years of nail-biting anxiety, consumer and business confidence were shot. Unemployment took a huge toll on Eurozone demand. Fiscal policy was constrained by the German drive to balance budgets. Perversely, Germany's trade surplus was surging at a time of plunging aggregate demand across the continent. It was a time, if there ever was one, for an active monetary policy. But stopping the bond market panic was one thing, reviving the Eurozone economy another. Unlike the Fed, Draghi had no mandate. As social misery deepened, as the sense of humiliation set in, what would be the reaction across Europe? Nor was it only the victims who were unsatisfied. German conservatives were indignant at Merkel's litany of compromises. In the German media, Draghi, the saviour of the Eurozone, faced hostility and doubt. Unless this German Euroscepticism could be overcome, there was little prospect of actually realising the agenda of ambitious integration and institution building that Draghi had trumpeted in his London speech. In the United States, Obama's re-election might energise his followers, but what exactly did his new American century consist of? What would be its priorities? In his first term, Obama had been preoccupied with overcoming the legacy of Bush's mistakes and coping with the crisis. But was the crisis really over? And even if it was, did that mean that America could face the future unencumbered? Or, having survived the crisis, did America now face the same challenges that had brought Obama as a junior senator to the launch of the Hamilton Project in 2006, challenges that had only amplified and intensified since? In foreign policy circles, the beginning of Obama's second term saw an impassioned argument over American retrenchment and the foundations of its international power. And in economic policy, too, there were skeptics. Had enough really changed to make another crisis less likely? Had the tensions within the financial system really been resolved, or merely contained? If another Great Depression had been avoided, did that have the perverse effect of removing the spur to truly profound reform? It was not without irony that among the Cassandras one of the loudest and most compelling voices was none other than Larry Summers, Treasury Secretary to Clinton and Chief Economic Advisor to Obama until December 2010. 12 months on from Obama's second election victory, at an IMF event in November 2013, Summers warned, "My lesson from this crisis, and my overarching lesson, which I have to say I think the world has under-internalized, is that it is not over until it is over, and that time is surely not right now." He could not have known how right he would turn out to be. Part 4. Aftershocks. Chapter 19. American Gothic. Amid the banking crisis of 2008, the American motor industry had been collateral damage. With sales collapsing, GM and Chrysler were knocked to their knees. In December 2008, a truculent Congress voted down an emergency aid package. But neither Bush nor Obama thought they could let GM and Chrysler fail. These once great powerhouses of American industrialism were rescued by diverting funds originally allocated to the bank bailout. By 2013, both GM and Chrysler were back in profit. Like the rest of American big business, they weathered the storm, and Chrysler celebrated its recovery in the way that corporate America does, by booking a slot to run a headline-grabbing commercial during the Super Bowl in February 2014. They wanted something that would make a splash, and they commissioned the man to do it. The spot was written, directed, and acted in person by Bob Dylan, the wizened bard of offbeat Americana. Against a backdrop of Hopper-esque noir, Dylan delivered a striking piece of high-caliber nationalist kitsch. "Is there anything more American than America? 'Cause you can't import original. You can't fake true cool. You can't duplicate legacy, because what Detroit created was a first and became an inspiration to the rest of the world. Yeah, Detroit made cars, and cars made America. Making the best, making the finest, takes conviction. and you can't import the heart and soul of every man and woman working on the line. You can search the world over for the finer things, but you won't find a match for the American road and the creatures that live on it. Because we believe in the zoom and the roar and the thrust, and when it's made here, it's made with the one thing you can't import from anywhere else, American pride. So let Germany brew your beer. Let Switzerland make your watch. Let Asia assemble your phone. We will build your car. His lines were all the more resonant because of what the audience could be expected to know about the place where the spot was filmed, Detroit. If the American motor industry was back from the dead, the same could not be said for Motor City. Since its heyday in the post-war era, Detroit had long been a city in decline. At its peak, it had a population of 1.8 million, of whom 500,000 were African American. Hit by deindustrialization and white flight following the 1967 riots, by 2013, the population of the urban core of Detroit had shrunk to 688,000, of whom 550,000 were African American. They were left behind in a city that was literally falling into ruin, burdened with debts running into the tens of billions of dollars. With most of the major factories that had made it one of the industrial heartlands of the world closed down, Detroit was caught in a death spiral of unemployment, racial disadvantage, and unsafe and predatory financing. By 2013, 36% of Detroit's population were classed as living below Michigan's far-from-generous poverty line. The unemployment rate was 18%. The city was an extreme example of the doom loop in which public and private financial distress compounded each other. In 2005, of all the mortgages in Detroit, 68% were subprime. As the crisis cut a swath across America, 65,000 homes in Detroit were foreclosed. Of those, 36,400 were considered of so little value that they were simply abandoned, joining a total stock of 140,000 blighted properties. Trying to contain the contamination effect, the city demolished entire tracts. Though it received state and federal subsidies for the house-raising program, it cost Detroit $195 million. That came on top of lost tax revenues of $300 million. None of this could the city afford. Detroit appointed an emergency manager, who in June 2013 filed for bankruptcy, with debts owing between $18 billion and $20 billion. It was the biggest city bankruptcy in American history. As viewers of Dylan's Chrysler Spot knew, Detroit was an extreme case. But it was not alone. Former industrial cities and towns across America were struggling. A few went bankrupt. In 2011, Jefferson County, Alabama, which included the steel city of Birmingham, had filed. In 2012, it was the turn of Stockton and San Bernardino, California. These were poorly governed places, burdened with the side effects of America's ramshackle welfare state, with economies struggling against long-term decline or the immediate impact of the real estate bust. They were far from being carbon copies of northern post-industrial Detroit. But taken together, they symbolized the bewildering turn from American dream to American nightmare. It wasn't new news. Already in the late 1970s, Bruce Springsteen had offered a mournful soundtrack for post-industrial America. In 2006, Obama had reminded the bigwigs of the Hamilton Project of the harsh realities of people in places like Decatur, Illinois, or Galesburg, Illinois. "This is not a bloodless process," he had said. But for most of Obama's first term, it wasn't the worries of such places that preoccupied economic policy. It was the fight to save Wall Street and global finance. The protests of 2011 and their politicization of inequality had begun to change the conversation. But it was in the 18 months following Obama's re-election in November 2012 that the sense of American malaise reached a new pitch. With the crisis no longer dominating the horizon, the concerns about America's long-term trajectory that had worried liberal centrists already in the early 2000s, the sense that things weren't normal, came roaring back. One unexpected but symptomatic manifestation was Larry Summers's minatory speech at the IMF in November 2013. His subject was the recovery and its deeply disappointing pace. American policymakers might congratulate themselves that they were leading the Europeans out of the recession, and they were right to do so. Since 2010, Europe's economic record had been even worse. But America's own recovery was the slowest on record. On the plucking model of business cycles, after a downward shock as severe as that in 2008, one might have expected the rebound to be vigorous. In 2009 to 2010, the recovery had started strongly, but since then economic growth had relapsed to a depressing extent. Where was the bounce? What was wrong? The conventional view was that the United States was suffering from the aftereffects of an exceptionally severe financial crisis. This was no ordinary business cycle. It would take time for markets and balance sheets to recover. It was precisely to avoid such hangovers that economists like Reinhardt and Rogoff argued for financial restraint. If you avoided the credit bubble and the excessive upswing, you might avoid the bust. Keynesians like Krugman insisted that this was all very well, but the recovery had been needlessly slowed by the premature shift to austerity. As Krugman put it punctually, it all went wrong in 2010. The global shift to austerity, for which Reinhardt and Rogoff had been the cheerleaders, reduced the recovery to an agonizing crawl. Bernanke's QE could compensate to some degree, but it could not make up for the shortfall in aggregate demand. These were the parameters of the economic policy debate familiar since 2009 and long before. What they did not capture was the sense that a deeper and more serious problem was afflicting America's economy and the society built on it. The hypothesis that Summers suggested to his audience at the IMF in November 2013 was disconcerting and unfamiliar. So jarring, in fact, that Summers, who is not given to either modesty or self-doubt, acknowledged, "This may all be madness, and I may not have this right at all." But in light of the data, the question had to be put. What if the inadequate recovery was not simply down to policy failure? What if there was a deeper problem, a chronic shortfall in the demand for investment relative to the supply of savings, resulting in a sustained condition of secular stagnation? To see the force of this argument, Summers invited his surprised audience to look back to the period before the crash. In retrospect, everyone agreed that monetary policy before 2008 had been too easy. There was a vast amount of imprudent lending going on. Almost everybody believes that wealth, as it was experienced by households, was in excess of its reality. Too easy money, too much borrowing, too much wealth. But if that were the case, one would have expected the American economy to have been on a dramatic bull run. It was not. Despite the excesses of the housing boom, growth up to 2008 had been average. Indeed, when compared with the 1950s and 1960s, it had been slow, which is why places like Detroit were in such a precarious position. Unemployment wasn't under any remarkably low level. Inflation was entirely quiescent. So somehow, even a great bubble wasn't enough to produce any excess in aggregate demand. So imagine, Summers continued the train of thought, how satisfactory the performance of the US economy would have been in the early 2000s in the absence of a housing bubble and with the maintenance of strong credit standards. It would have been just as disappointing as the current recovery was turning out to be. It might have been worse. In an astonishing makeover of America's recent economic history, Summers proposed that for at least two decades, American economic growth had been on weak foundations. To achieve no more than a normal rate of growth, it had depended on abnormal financial bubbles. Looking back over recent decades, Summers asked in a subsequent speech, "Can we identify any sustained stretch during which the economy grew satisfactorily with conditions that were financially sustainable?" Perhaps one can find some such period, but it is very much the minority rather than the majority of the historical experience. It was a remarkable indictment of the policy consensus of which Summers himself had been a defining figure. It had dramatic implications for current policy. If America simply waited, the long-awaited rebound from the crisis of 2008 might never arrive. To address the chronic shortfall in investment, what Summers advocated was a new era of government activism. The United States would not match China, of course, nor was that appropriate, but the conditions were right for a big burst of public investment. This would rebuild America's infrastructure, and in so doing, it would address the more fundamental questions posed by Detroit. Physical reconstruction would be a means to restore a sense of national coherence and national pride. As Summers remarked on another occasion, "Look at Kennedy Airport. It is an embarrassment as an entry point to the leading city in the leading country in the world. The wealthiest, by flying privately, largely escape its depredations. Fixing it would employ substantial numbers of people who work with their hands and provide a significant stimulus to employment and growth. If a moment when the United States can borrow at lower than 3% in a currency we print ourselves, and when the unemployment rate for construction workers hovers above 10% is not the right moment to do it, when will that moment come?" Belatedly, what Summers was calling for was what Obama's administration had failed to deliver: a concerted drive to unify American society around a sustained program of investment-driven growth and comprehensive modernization. The efforts at stimulus in 2009 and 2010 had not been negligible, but they had been hedged around by the anxieties of the moment: resistance from Congress, a spectacular and aggressive mobilization of right-wing opinion, and Larry Summers's own nervousness about losing standing with the savvy political operatives. The result was a recovery that was not just slow, but deeply inequitable. If the shocking images of dilapidation in Detroit and other post-industrial cities around America were not enough, devastating statistical data completed the picture. In October 2013, two French economists, one working in California, the other back in Paris, published the latest release of a long-running project on American inequality. Emmanuel Saez and Thomas Piketty were at this point not unknown. An earlier paper in which they mapped top incomes in the United States over the long run had yielded the "We are the 99%" slogan that the Occupy movement had used to such good effect. Nevertheless, the data they released in October 2013 were astonishing. From the latest round of tax releases, they calculated that of the growth generated by the economic recovery since 2009, 95% had been monopolized by the top 1%. That tiny fraction of the population saw their incomes rebound from the trough of the recession by 31.4%. Meanwhile, 99% of Americans had experienced virtually no gain in income since the crisis. The data were subsequently revised to show a less extreme disproportion, but in 2013 the numbers were a sensation. The slow growth in GDP that worried Summers, in fact, hid two radically divergent realities. Whereas a tiny elite were doing extremely well, for average Americans, the secular stagnation thesis that Summers advanced as a tentative academic hypothesis was simply the lived reality of the last 40 years. Since America's bicentennial in 1976, productivity growth, which drove overall economic growth, and the returns to labor in the form of household incomes had starkly diverged. The average American shared only to a small degree in national economic growth as measured by GDP statistics. Almost all the benefits of growth were being monopolized by the highest paid and those wealthy enough to own significant portfolios of financial assets. The financial crisis of 2008 had revealed how, in extremis, national economic policy was subordinated to the needs of a cluster of giant transnational banks. Now, in the face of a dismal recovery, the correspondence between economic growth and the progress of a national society was being challenged from the bottom up. Could the national economy any longer be plausibly presented as a project common to all Americans? The decay of the American dream had been a staple of Barack Obama's political discourse since his days as a junior senator. It was a common thread in the Hamilton Project agenda. In December 2013, a year into his second term as president, Obama visited a community center in Ward 8, an African-American section of Washington, D.C., to make a major speech about America's ongoing social crisis. He described the daily battles of ordinary Americans struggling against the relentless decades-long trend toward dangerous and growing inequality. "The basic bargain at the heart of our economy has frayed," he declared. Of course, the trend toward growing inequality was not confined to America. But, Obama insisted, there must be no more evasion. "This increasing inequality is most pronounced in our country. Statistics show that our levels of income inequality rank near countries like Jamaica and Argentina. Comparable wealthy allies, countries like Canada or Germany or France, have greater mobility than we do, not less. Half of all Americans would experience poverty during at least one period of their lives. The combined trends of increased inequality and decreasing mobility pose a fundamental threat to the American dream, our way of life, and what we stand for around the globe." Inequality was, the president declared, the defining challenge of our time. The racialized distress of cities like Detroit was clearly shocking. But, as Obama emphasized, America's crisis was not confined to predominantly African-American communities. Across the country, class, not race, was the most important determinant of an American's life chances, and the big story of his second term as president was rural white working-class despair. It was Appalachia, West Virginia and Kentucky, held back by structural change, educational failure and immobility, that lurched into the headlines. At its most extreme, this lethal cocktail came to be symbolized by an epidemic of drug addiction, fed by cheap heroin from Mexico and rampant opioid abuse. Already in 2007, deaths from drug overdose had overtaken road accidents as a major cause of death in the United States. Among white Americans, deaths from overdose increased by 297% between 2010 and 2014 alone. Unlike in any other developed society, life expectancy among working-class white Americans had been decreasing since the early 2000s. In modern history, the only obvious parallel was with Russia in the desperate aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union. One journalistic essay and academic research paper after another confirmed the disaster, until the narrative was capped in 2015 by Anne Case and Angus Deaton's famous account of Deaths of Despair. The crisis was undeniable. The question was what to do about it. When the left wing of the Democratic Party had taken up the issue of inequality in the 1990s at the time of the Clinton administration, the standard diagnosis had been technical and economic. Globalization had pushed top incomes up and lower incomes down. Since the 1990s, the impact of these factors had only increased. Imports of cheap manufacturers opened up by NAFTA and Chinese accession to the WTO benefited consumers, but depressed wages and robbed blue-collar Americans of secure manufacturing jobs and the health and retirement benefits that went with them. By 2013, experts close to the American labor movement estimated that the trade deficit with China had cost 3.2 million jobs, and the competition of low-wage foreign labor had depressed the wages of the 100 million American workers without college education by $180 billion. These were substantial effects, but in an economy with a workforce of more than 150 million and a wage bill of more than $7 trillion, they were nowhere near large enough to explain the huge surge in inequality. So globalization was supplemented by the thesis of skills-biased technological change. This postulated that, independent of globalization and foreign trade, the trend in technological development had offered disproportionate benefits to those with higher skills in every walk of life and across the entire American economy, whether exposed to trade or not. The standard reformist response was to advocate for a role for federal and state government in improving education, providing affordable access to community colleges, and offering trade adjustment assistance. hence the focus of the Hamilton Project in 2006 on making sure that underprivileged kids made good use of their summer vacations. But after 20 years, given the mounting inequality and declining mobility, these measures could hardly be deemed a success. Disillusionment with conventional reformist solutions was a hallmark of the new inequality debate that sprang to life after 2011. Though there had been many well-intentioned efforts by government agencies to modify and improve the condition of average Americans, on balance, their net effect had been modest, to say the least. Between 1977 and 2014, the share of national income going to the top 1% before taxes and benefits had risen by 88.8%. After fiscal redistribution, their share increased by 81.4%. Nor did the tax and welfare state prevent the share of the bottom 50% from declining from 25.6% to 19.4%. Nor was this by accident. Every conceivable source of leverage and influence had been exploited by those with money to maximize their advantage. As billionaire investor Warren Buffett famously put it, "Actually, there's been class warfare going on for the last 20 years, and my class has won." Buffett was so appalled at the consequences that in 2011 he made himself into a spokesman for proposals to impose a minimum 35% tax on America's highest earners, a proposal that Obama had backed, but that had been blocked by the Republicans in Congress. It was a sign of both Buffett's personal decency and the utter lopsidedness of the balance of power in 21st century America that a program of social improvement should consist of well-meaning billionaires volunteering to pay a bit more for the greater good of American society. For those at the bottom of the pile, none of this was news. Opinion polls, especially those commissioned by the right wing, had for a long time been recording the profound resentment among the American population at the way that both the economy and the political system seemed to be engineered to their disadvantage. These views were often dismissed as conspiracy theory, and often deservedly so. Online news sources like Breitbart, which rode to prominence on the back of the Tea Party movement, provided a platform for toxic, racial, and anti-Semitic rhetoric. But if one stepped back from the poisonous language and crude logic, the assumption that inequality was systemic and that the system was rigged against ordinary working-class Americans were not paranoid, but simply realistic. From a radically different perspective, and with completely different intent, the American left had always made the case. Indeed, it was this radical skepticism that set them apart from the liberal centrists who dominated the Democratic Party. The left did not trust the institutions. They did not believe that electing well-intentioned products of elite colleges to steer a machine designed to favor the wealthy offered any hope of fundamental change. As the Occupy slogan of 2011 put it, "The system isn't broken, it's rigged." In many ways, the liberal centrists were the last to know. They, of all the segments of political opinion, had the most invested in the idea that America's social ills were amenable to technocratic remedy, and that the state was a suitable instrument for making such change. It was precisely the conversion of commentators of this ilk to a more radical view that marked how serious the sense of crisis had become. In a remarkable series of articles following the 2012 election, Paul Krugman at the New York Times adopted a profoundly dark view of American society, economy, and politics. "What do the pre- and post-crisis consensuses have in common?" Krugman asked in December 2013. "Both were economically destructive. Deregulation helped make the crisis possible, and the premature turn to fiscal austerity has done more than anything else to hobble recovery. Both consensuses, however, corresponded to the interests and prejudices of an economic elite whose political influence had surged along with its wealth. Some pundits might wish to depoliticize our economic discourse to make it technocratic and non-partisan. But that's a pipe dream. Even on what may look like purely technocratic issues, class and inequality end up shaping and distorting the debate." This, from a Nobel Prize-winning economist who in the 1980s and 1990s had counted squarely in the mainstream. Robert Reich, a former Clinton-era Labour secretary, underwent a similar disillusionment at exactly the same historical moment. For a quarter century, he now admitted, I've offered in books and lectures an explanation for why average working people in advanced nations like the United States have failed to gain ground and are under increasing economic stress. He had pitted an interventionist state against the forces of globalization and technological change. What Reich now recognized was that much of this was insufficient, if not beside the point, because it overlooked a critically important phenomenon, the increasing concentration of political power in a corporate and financial elite that has been able to influence the rules by which the economy runs. The problem is not the size of government, but whom the government is for. After the events of 2008 and 2009, and the spectacularly lopsided bailouts, could anyone seriously doubt whom government was for? At the level of personnel, the revolving door that connected the Treasury, the Fed, and the top banks continued to spin at a steady pace. By 2014, both Bernanke and Geithner were on their way from public service to well-upholstered positions in finance. Geithner went to the well-connected investment bank Warburg Pincus. Bernanke advised the Citadel Hedge Fund and chaired an advisory board for the giant PIMCO bond fund owned by Allianz of Germany, which also included as its members Jean-Claude Trichet and Gordon Brown, as well as Anne-Marie Slaughter of the Obama foreign policy team. It was like a mini-reunion of 2008 crisis fighters. And they had plenty to celebrate. Share values were recovering to their pre-crisis levels and beyond. The banks were rebuilding their balance sheets. As they piled up capital and reserves, rates of return in the financial sector were down. But as the stress tests had always intended, pre-provision net revenue was bouncing back, and the extra capital made the banks safer. America's financial giants were expanding their businesses, pushing into markets vacated by their ailing European competitors. Clearly, Wall Street enjoyed a privileged connection to government. After 2008, no one could doubt that. But what was striking in the aftermath of the crisis was how critical commentary on America's political economy widened its scope beyond the banks. In so doing, it followed the evolving contours of the economy itself. With the advent of the smartphone and social media boom in 2007, tech had regained the luster it had lost in the dot-com crash. Silicon Valley was the new cutting edge of American capitalism. Big Pharma continued to rake in profits. As oil prices resurged from their lows in 2009, big oil and the new technology of fracking were back. As the recession of 2008 to 2009 receded, what came ever more to the fore was a tendency toward concentration and oligopoly that went far beyond Wall Street. One of the side effects of Bernanke's QE policy of low interest rates was that it made it hugely attractive for companies to borrow to buy out their competitors. In three giant merger waves cresting in 2000, 2006, and 2015, with the antitrust authorities looking on, American capitalism remade itself in a more concentrated and monopolistic mode. By 2013, profits were booming to an almost embarrassing extent. Even chronic loss-makers like the airlines were now making money. But the really big returns were elsewhere. As Peter Orszag, Obama's former director of management and budget, now at Citigroup, and Jason Furman, serving as chair of the Council of Economic Advisers, reported in a research paper, two-thirds of the non-financial firms that had managed to achieve a return on invested capital of 45% or more between 2010 and 2014 were in either the healthcare or information technology sectors. What allowed such gigantic profits and enormous salaries to be concentrated in these sectors were market power, IP protection, and government-licensed pricing. Silicon Valley saw no need to apologize. Theirs was the great technological and entrepreneurial success story of the late 20th and early 21st centuries. Antitrust, data protection, and intrusive tax investigations were, as far as Tim Cook of Apple was concerned, nothing more than political crap, antiquated road bumps on the highway to the future. As tech oligarch Peter Thiel told audiences and readers, creating value isn't enough. You also need to capture some of the value you create. That depended on market power. Americans mythologize competition and credit it with saving us from socialist breadlines. But Thiel knew better. As far as he was concerned, capitalism and competition are opposites. Capitalism is premised on the accumulation of capital, but under perfect competition, all profits get competed away. The lesson for entrepreneurs is clear. Competition is for losers. One could hardly ask for a more crass statement of robber baron hubris. The implications were bleak. America's massively skewed distribution of income and wealth was the product of inherited assets amplified by pervasive technological and economic change and Warren Buffett's class war, which extended to every facet of the political regulation and deregulation of the economy. If this was so, what would it take to counteract the imbalance and to redress the astonishingly one-sided outcomes? A polite European social democrat like Thomas Piketty inferred from his inequality data that what the world needed was a global wealth tax. This was the message of his remarkable global bestseller, Capital in the 21st Century, which redefined the public debate about inequality in 2014. That would certainly help to offset the tendency toward massive inequality, but in a system as starkly polarized and lopsided as that of the United States, what relevance did such well-meaning suggestions have? The tax proposal wasn't wrong. It just sidestepped the reason it was needed in the first place. The brutal struggle for privilege and power, which for decades had enabled those at the top to accumulate huge wealth untroubled by any serious effort at redistribution. The answer, if there was one, was clearly not technical. It was political in the most comprehensive sense. Power had to be met with power. In January 2014, Reich went to Congress to testify. "I've served in Washington, and know how difficult it is to get anything done unless the broad public understands what's at stake and actively pushes for reform. That's why we need a movement against economic inequality and in favor of shared growth, a movement on a scale similar to the progressive movement at the turn of the last century that fueled the first progressive income tax and antitrust laws, the women's suffrage movement that got women the vote, the labor movement that helped animate the New Deal of the 1930s and fueled the great prosperity of the first three decades after World War II, the civil rights movement that achieved the landmark Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts, and the environmental movement that spawned the Environmental Protection Act and other critical legislation." Reich's call to arms was powerful and compelling. To fix a rigged system, what was needed was a comprehensive mobilization. But as Reich was only too well aware, the progressive left were not the only ones who could draw this conclusion. In fact, the American right wing got there first. Unlike liberal progressives, the libertarian right wing in the United States had never doubted that government was a problem. Indeed, they had always vociferously argued that it was the entire problem. America's downward slide, the long-running trends toward inequality and oligarchy, the disaster of 2008, the lopsided recovery from it, were all symptoms of the profound corruption brought about by big government meddling and its capture by interest groups. Obama's crisis politics were simply the latest phase. In response to Obama's December 2013 inequality speech, Fox News speakers did not hesitate to mobilize the extraordinary Piketty and Sayers data on the lopsidedness of the recovery, but only to turn them against the president. "He's saying he wants to take out inequality, and his policies from the beginning have been to equalize. But what had happened to inequality under the Obama administration?" the Fox anchors demanded to know. "The top 1%, their income rose by 31.4% between 2009 and 2012. Income for everyone else, you know how much that grew? 0.4%. These are just facts here. 95% of income gains have gone to the top 1%. So this system that he's talking about, he is the system. It's his system." Of course, the low top tax rates that had helped to create that outcome of extreme disparity were set by Republican Congress and kept there by them. But the polemic was telling. A large part of the American right agreed with Obama that the American dream was in trouble. But for them, he was the personification of everything that was wrong. His defeat of Mitt Romney in 2012 only vindicated them in their belief that existing Republican politics were hopelessly inadequate. The Republicans would never achieve the transformation they craved with a candidate like Romney, an upper-class banker. In 2013, while the Democrats were still lulled by the sweet scent of Obama's second victory, the right counterattacked. Their target was the great social policy initiative of Obama's first term, the Affordable Care Act. The hostage they would take was the budget. In 2011, the Tea Party caucus had come close to forcing the United States into fiscal crisis. That had been avoided at the last minute by a compromise under which a bipartisan supercommittee would make recommendations on deficit reduction. When that failed to reach agreement in January 2012, it meant that automatic sequester cuts would be triggered in January 2013, affecting the entire government machine, including defense. This non-discretionary mechanism was popular with the Reaganite fiscal reform crowd. Among the loudest and most influential voices for budget cuts was the coalition of business interests and Washington insiders gathered by Peter G. Peterson in the Fix the Debt campaign. They had a strong preference for entitlement cuts and, given their suspicion of the kind of political crap that frustrated businessmen and policy experts alike, automatic sequester was far from being the worst of all possible worlds. As Obama's ex-budget director Peter Orszag put the argument in October 2011, in the wake of the first budget showdown with the Tea Party, "To solve the serious problems facing our country, we need to minimize the harm from legislative inertia by relying more on automatic policies and depoliticized commissions for certain policy decisions. In other words, radical as it sounds, we need to counter the gridlock of our political institutions by making them a bit less democratic. We need to jettison the Civics 101 fairy tale about pure representative democracy and instead begin to build a new set of rules and institutions that would make legislative inertia less detrimental to our nation's long-term health." Unless something was done, the automatic cuts coming down the road in 2013 were huge. $563 billion in a single year, a contractionary anti-stimulus that might well trigger a new recession. To avoid this disaster, tense negotiations began in the hope of reaching a deal. The so-called grand bargain worked out between Obama and Boehner in 2011 was a lopsided demonstration of Washington's rigged politics in action. It traded deep cuts in entitlements for some carefully chosen increases in taxes that would hit higher-income households but cushion job-creating and growth-generating businesses. To the left, it was outrageous. The mainstream deficit reduction campaign was riddled with conflicts of interest. Many of the most active exponents of entitlement cuts were lobbyists for targeted tax exemptions. As one cynical observer put it, "It's easier to get FaceTime in Washington as a deficit hawk than as a corporate hack." Meanwhile, the effort by Peterson lobbyists to present the austerity movement as a grassroots and youth-driven movement was exposed as a risible joke. The campaign included a bus tour of college campuses called The Can Kicks Back, a bizarre YouTube clip in which the venerable Senator Alan Simpson was persuaded to dance Gangnam Style, and a cack-handed effort to deluge Congress with scripted letters from indignant teens protesting the debt burden their grandparents were threatening to pass down to them. It wasn't so much grassroots as astroturf. Countering the post-truth of the mainstream austerity campaign made for good journalistic exposés. It also made sense for the left to focus its fire on the likes of Peterson, Orszag, Simpson, and Bowles, who were assumed to be the real power brokers in Washington. What no one reckoned with was the astonishing aggression and energy of the far right, which was not interested in reducing government so much as stopping it altogether. The Tea Party caucus inside the Republican Party was a small, determined, and well-funded group. As far as deficit reduction was concerned, they would accept only spending cuts. and the spending they wanted to stop, in particular, was Obamacare, which they regarded as a lethal, socialist threat to America's future. The Republican leadership might worry about losing centrist votes. They knew that the budget crisis of 2011 had not played well with the electorate. But the most hardcore Tea Party advocates did not listen. To the Taliban of the right, it was clear that Romney had lost because he was a moderate, compromising on immigration and health care. The only way to win back the electorate, at least the electorate in their gerrymandered Republican congressional districts, was to take the hardest line possible. By January 2013, no cross-party agreement had been reached. The automatic sequester was put off for 2 months by stopgap legislation. Meanwhile, the debt limit was raised sufficiently to cover spending until May. With a substantial section of the Republicans agreeing to modest tax increases on the highest earners and on large inheritances, it seemed as though a crisis might be avoided. But the timeline was now pressing. On March 1st, the sequester cuts came into full effect, hitting the budgets of the military, FEMA, the FBI, the FDA, and the SEC. America's apparatus of government began to go into hibernation. In 2013, the sluggish economic recovery in the United States would be further slowed down by a fiscal tightening equivalent to almost 1% of global GDP. The United States moved from being significantly more expansive than the EU in 2008 to 2009 to being far more contractionary. Meanwhile, to keep basic government functions going, ad hoc spending authorizations were approved to cover the federal government through September. Crafting a proper budget for 2014 was more than Congress could manage. On March 21st, March 23rd, and April 10th, first the House, then the Senate, and finally the White House released separate budget proposals. The Senate and the White House were close together in terms of both the deficit reduction, $1.8 to $1.9 trillion over 10 years, and the balance of spending cuts and tax increases they proposed. The Republicans in the House were in a different world. They called for much bigger cuts, $4.6 trillion over 10 years, to be achieved entirely by slashing spending. The House would not consider the Senate budget, and neither the Senate nor the House would vote on the White House proposal. The incoherence of U.S. fiscal policy was reaching a new pitch. On May 19th, the debt ceiling was reinstated at a level that covered borrowing since suspension in February, but without provision for any new debt. The Treasury was therefore forced back on the expedients it had resorted to in 2011, raiding government cash tills and running down reserve funds. By mid-October, the Treasury would run out of money and be forced to prioritize bill payments. It would be tantamount to a selective default. To prepare for this contingency, mainstream Republicans in May 2013 proposed a bill to ensure that at least the government's bondholders were paid. To John Boehner, the conventionally minded Republican leader in the House, this seemed like a sensible first step to order the federal government's affairs in case of bankruptcy. But the Democrats had no interest in making the unthinkable more manageable, and the proposal that Chinese creditors should be paid ahead of serving military and Social Security recipients made easy political meat. The Full Faith and Credit Act was soon dubbed the Pay China First Act, and voted down by the Democrats. Obama announced that he would veto the bill if it passed. With the summer having gone by without any movement toward a deal, on September 25th, the Treasury announced that it would run out of cash on October 17th, 2013. Nancy Pelosi appealed to Boehner to remember the sacrifice that the Democrats had made to pass the TARP program for President Bush. But that cut no ice with a Republican majority that did not remember the Bush years fondly and was